You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host, and with me today is the CEO of the Lincoln Center for Performing Arts, Henry Timms. We'll get to talk to Henry about the important work going on at the Lincoln Center as it manages its way through the pandemic that has affected most arts organizations, not only in America, but around the world. We'll also speak with him about Giving Tuesday, as he was one of the co-founders of the Giving Tuesday movement that now has us reaching deep into our pockets the first Tuesday after Thanksgiving to support our favorite charitable organizations. And in connection with that, we'll get to talk with him about a book he wrote called New Power, because it follows through on some of the movement building work that he did at Giving Tuesday. And it helps us understand everything that we're experiencing now and perhaps is a roadmap for what we're about to experience in the future. Henry, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
How are you? It's great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you with me today. And I feel like we are tapping into the brains of a social genius.
But first, Henry Timms.
So, Henry, first of all, how are things going at the Lincoln Center? And if you don't mind, give our listeners a little taste of the kind of things that you generally do there and how things are going now, given the pandemic and how it's affecting arts organizations.
You know, Lincoln Center obviously is a very large art center. We have 10 different constituents on campus. We've got 16 acres in Manhattan. We have everyone from jazz at Lincoln Center to the Metropolitan Opera to New York Philharmonic. So you have this amazing collection of incredible institutions. But all the arts organizations across our country have been challenged so greatly because the fundamental service that we provide, which is connecting people in very human ways, right? That's what we do with the arts. Hasn't been possible, right? There's been this long period of disconnection, of distance, of distrust. And the arts have obviously struggled greatly because it hasn't been able to open up our halls or our theaters or our rehearsal spaces in the way that we typically do. So it's been a very tough time. I'd say two things, I think, in general. One is, I think the arts world deserves enormous credit because there's been so much creativity during this period. So many different organizations have come forward with new ways of connecting, with ways of making people feel closer to each other. And I think that's really, really important. And I'll give you a couple of examples. I remember the very beginning of the pandemic. I bet you can all remember there was a video of a street in Italy, in Siena, I think, and the lockdown had just begun and everyone was staying in their homes. And you remember that was a time we were all scrubbing our food as it came in the house and no one really knew what was going on. And in the evenings along this covered street, people would lean out the windows and sing together. It's a beautiful moment of kind of people connecting. And then you saw around the world, happened here in New York, happened around the country, that at 7 o'clock each night, you would see people coming together to clap out their windows, right? And it's such an interesting, I remember every time I saw that, I thought this is such an example of the power of the arts, which is even when we're trapped indoors, even when we're not supposed to connect with each other, human beings are going to find a way of making some music. And so like that 7 o'clock orchestra was, I thought, such a meaningful thing. So you've seen this kind of real service of the arts community during this time. And then I think what you're beginning to see next is as part of the recovery, and I hope this is true of Lincoln Center, and I know it's true of lots of arts organizations around the country, that along with the economic recovery everyone's so focused on, there is a social recovery, right? There is a recovery beginning to happen about who we are as human beings. And the arts, you know, we get distracted in the arts, right? Sometimes we serve too few people. We can come across as very elitist. We can put up these big barriers for entry that don't really help anybody. But at our heart, what the arts community does is helps us navigate what it is to be human, right? What it is to feel fear, what it is to feel love, what it is to feel proximity, what it is to feel distance, all of the things that make up the human condition that aren't easily fit onto spreadsheets are what the arts investigate. So I think there's also a very optimistic focus now in the arts world, which is for all the challenges we have faced, the arts is going to be called on to help with that social recovery.
Yeah. Are you expecting sort of a big rush once we're all vaccinated and we can begin to feel a little bit closer to what we had before the pandemic?
Hell yes. I mean, I think that people have been stuck inside forever, right? And people, human beings need to be together. And like there was, I remember a wave of when everyone was getting very excited about Zoom and it was like, well, we'll be on Zoom. We'll never need to go to the offices again. We can stay and be basement people and then connect around the world. And like, and then, you know, I think pretty quickly it became clear that actually that human, I'm sorry, there's some Spanish homework going on in the background.
That's okay.
So, but that's also part of the, that's also, I think, part of the pandemic is one of the barriers which has collapsed a little is the barrier between work and home, right? So I think that barrier too has changed us all as human beings. So I think people are going to really want to come back. I mean, people are going to want to come back. They're going to want to be together. They're going to want to connect with each other. I think congregation, as soon as it's safe, people are going to want to be with other people and experiencing things as groups, right? We are herd animals, right? We want to be together. We want to be sociable. And so I think it will be nuts, actually. Once it's safe, I think people will be desperate to be out.
Henry, you know, one of the big things I love about our country is that we get to decide what philanthropic activities matter most to us. And in America, there is a plethora of causes and organizations and social missions that we all go for. And from time to time, though, people will say or try to rank, I guess, the relative importance of organizations. And I see that many times people will say, well, we need to take care of the hungry first before we worry about what's going on in an arts organization. And you mentioned the word elitist, too. But I think people may not really grasp the importance of arts and arts organizations, for that matter, to our very existence. And I would like for you to maybe share with us your own perspective on that. It's a lot more than the performance, isn't it?
Yes. And I think the... Let me try and give you an example. Look, I think it's an important question. And I often feel that the people who are posing that question are trying to get us into this kind of hunger games of charities as to who matters more, right? And of course, if there's one thing that we all recognize is that we need lots of nonprofits to provide lots of services to have a full life, right? To have a full and a just life. That is not one sector nor one cause. So I think that's an important point. Equally, like in the last year, I think we'd be crazy not to pretend that there were many, many points where clearly medical needs were the priority of the nation and they should be, right? No one in that moment is going to say, you know, it's actually much more important that we focus on symphony orchestras. It's just clearly that's not the case. And no one sensible was making an argument like that. But I think the argument you can make is to say that the world is not made up of one thing alone. I'll give you an example from our work last year. Right after the first big surge, when, you know, things were in a way their most bleak and most confusing, we were talking to a group of different faith leaders, Christians and Muslims and Jews in New York, who were all struggling with the same problem. And their problem was they had people who were dying and they had no way to memorialize them, no funerals to be had in traditional ways. So we worked with all of them and came up with an idea called Memorial for Us All. The way Memorial for Us All worked, it was a weekly concert online from Lincoln Center. And each week was a great artist performing a tribute. And New Yorkers could submit names. And then as the music was being performed, people's names would scroll across the screen in tribute to them. So it became a way of memorializing people, like a crowdsourced memorial service. And so thousands of New Yorkers sent names in. And so as Yo-Yo Ma would be playing the names of their loved ones would pass the screen, and it would be a small way for them to engage. And the reason that I mention that example is because when you get into this idea of ranking charities or what's more valuable than the rest of it, you have to recognize that there are moments in life where different things matter for different reasons. And certainly there are things which, in my mind, become the most human parts of our lives when the arts matter enormously, right? If you think about every funeral you've ever been to, in those moments where we run out of words to describe someone's life, we turn to music, right? That's how we help understand them. You go to a wedding, and the great celebrations of life, a wedding or a baptism or an anniversary, and every single time we'll run out of words that help us explain joy, so we'll turn to music, we'll turn to song, we'll turn to dancing. And the thing I think about the arts is not to get into a kind of, you know, a Hunger Games situation with other charities, but to recognize that to live a full life, we all have to work out who we are as human beings and who we are as societies. And the arts are one tool to help us navigate the human condition. And certainly in my mind, that's of their true value. And I'll make two specific points about that. One is, at a time when we have all been shaken so greatly, I think the arts will provide an enormous service in the years ahead to help us find ourselves again, right? To help us kind of reconnect, to process this period, to process these moments. Artists will help us with that. And secondly, as importantly, I think the arts will help us find each other, right? We've been a world, the whole story of our world has been about distance, right? Social distance, political distance, distance from different communities. You only look now at the anti-Asian sentiment in this country. You look at the great challenges many different populations in this country face on an ongoing basis. And one thing the arts actually does very well, I think, is help us understand other people, helps us kind of glimpse other people's cultures, understand their worlds. And at a time when America needs to re-engage with the world, we all need to re-engage with each other. We've got to find some sense of a shared narrative again. With all of those themes developing, I think the arts are going to be called on to play a really critical role in the years ahead.
Wonderful. So, Henry, how much of a shift has it been for you to come from a venerable organization like 92Y, where you were prior to your time at Lincoln Center, to now take the helm there? And I would ask also, what was it that you expected to achieve there prior to the pandemic that may be different now, or if not different, why not different?
So the 92nd Street Y, for those who are not New Yorkers, is an Upper East Side institution. It's a cultural and community center. It's a Jewish organization, but it serves people of all backgrounds. It has like a very famous talk series. It has a great senior center. It does a great camps program. It's this kind of glorious cultural and community center. And it was a great opportunity. It was a great privilege to lead that organization. But it taught you a lot. It taught me a lot of lessons that have been really helpful for Lincoln Center. So one of them is that the 92nd Street Y was a very cross-disciplinary organization. You know, on any one day, you would find yourself, you know, dealing with the work we were doing in the school system, through to dealing with, you know, end-of-life issues with the senior center, through to dealing with a, you know, a very famous poet who was coming in the evening. So you got used to this idea of lots of diverse things happening at once, which is certainly true of Lincoln Center. And the second thing I think it really helped me with was thinking about complicated institutions. And, you know, all institutions are complicated, but especially those institutions who have kind of had good 20th centuries, who then have to reimagine themselves for the 21st century. You know, that's what we did. The 92nd Street Y is 143 years old. Lincoln Center is 61 years old. And in both cases, I think what my belief was that these great institutions have to change, have to evolve, have to be reimagined. But if they do, they can really provide a very deep and meaningful service. So the kind of the theme between the two jobs, and this sounds like I thought it through at the time, which I didn't, but I can see it. You know, you can only see the patterns in your own life after them, right? You can only look back to see how it made sense. But there was kind of a sense of how you think about transforming institutions, which I think has been at the theme of my day job, and indeed at the theme of a lot of the work I've done outside the day job.
So what might we expect to see from Lincoln Center as we come out of the pandemic?
Well, I'll give you some examples. So we really at Lincoln Center, we set a strategy before the pandemic, which became more urgent because of it. And the strategy was essentially point one, how do we think about the city we live in, the organizations we represent, how do we serve them better? Point two, how do we think about diversity, equity, and inclusion? How can we be sure that we are serving more people more fully? And point three, how do we think about innovation? How do we reimagine our world? That was a strategy we set, the board set, before we went into the pandemic. And of course, every one of those ideas has become more important, right? It's become more important that we focus on kickstarting the city, getting behind the organizations who are on our campus. It's become even more urgent that we focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion after the, of course, the murder of George Floyd and the whole raft of social justice issues on all of our mind last year. And it's become very important we think about innovation, because the models that we've cherished in the performing arts, in some cases for centuries, haven't been available to us, right? We haven't been able to fill halls with performers and with audiences. So we've had to find new ways to engage. So those three themes, I think, are the right themes for Lincoln Center. So we're really about, I think, doing the things we've always done, always been an organization which is about the highest levels of performance and achievement, but increasingly becoming an organization that is also about the widest possible sense of engagement and inclusion. And we're at the beginning of that journey, but I think that's the journey we need to take as an organization.
Henry, this podcast is all about giving, and because of your work, your name is now synonymous with giving. You are co-founder of a movement that we call Giving Tuesday. And I dare say many of us listening, if not all of us listening, will find a way to dig into our pockets, write a check, send a contribution to our favorite charity. And most people probably have no idea where this came from or how it started. We just say, hey, I'm going to give on Giving Tuesday. Tell us about what inspired you to do this and how in the world it became so successful.
I remember we were thinking a lot about, 92nd Street Y, that's where I was working at the time, which was a community center, right? And so the way we thought about community historically was you would get people to come to the building. They would come to the building, you would do something which would create community, and that was how you served. And of course, we were thinking then, how do you reimagine community, right? How do you think differently about the digital world and how you can take the same set of values and scale them, right? So that was the general work we were doing at the Y, was about that sense of reimagining the organization. And Giving Tuesday came out of that kind of mindset, was where Giving Tuesday came from, that we were thinking, all right, well, look, you've got Black Friday and you've got Cyber Monday, these days when the commercial world has got together and they've persuaded everybody, we ought to stand in line outside Walmart, and you'd see those pictures of people, fighting in lines to get their hands on the flat screen TVs. And then you had Cyber Monday, which was all about getting people to buy things online. And so the thought was, well, could you reverse the trend, right? Could you reverse it from getting things to giving things? So rather than having 2 days that were all about consumption, could you have a day that was more about compassion? That was the original idea of Giving Tuesday. I remember one of the first taglines we had was, we have 2 days for getting things, and here's 1 day for giving back. That was the simple premise of Giving Tuesday. And it really caught on for a bunch of reasons. I think one of them was, like, Tuesday was in play. I remember thinking very clearly that, right? There's Black Friday, there's Cyber Monday, like someone is going to grab Tuesday for something soon. So it really should be the nonprofit sector, right? We better stake our claim. I remember a lot of people told us at the time, you need to wait a year and do more planning. There's one lesson from Giving Tuesday is don't do too much planning. They said, no, this really entrepreneurial guy sat down. He said, it's a really interesting idea, but you ought to plan it and do a business plan and, do some strategic thinking and some market analysis and all the good things we're told to do. And we didn't do any of those things. We just said, now we're going to grab the date, because if we don't grab it, someone else is going to grab it. So that was the idea. And then I think we made a decision early on, which was important, around branding. So Giving Tuesday was not, I was working at the 92nd Street Y at the time. It wasn't ever called the 92nd Street Y's Giving Tuesday, right? I remember talking to a board member early on, and I was explaining this idea, we're going to do this thing called Giving Tuesday, and it will be after Black Friday and Cyber Monday, and it will be a really good way of kind of getting people to connect around the country and give back and volunteer. And he said, it's great, I love it. And where's our logo going to go? Is our logo going to go between Giving and Tuesday? And I'm like, no, we're not going to put our logo on it, because if we stamp this with our brand, if we stamp our ownership on this, nobody else will own it, right? It will be the our thing. So we were very much about, I remember, and I haven't thought about this for a long time, one of the early things we wrote on a post-it note was tools, not rules. And Tools Not Rules was a reminder, which was like, let's not go into this assuming that we just need to tell people not to do things or that they have to do things, right? Here's where our logo should go. Here's how you have to give. Here's how you have to think about it. But let's go into it with the mindset of what could we possibly do to provide tools to encourage giving? How would we think about that? And so, you know, we talked to a bunch of people back then. We built a group of people to help support the idea. You know, you were one of them, right back at the beginning when we were talking to people and just saying, look, we've got this idea. Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Giving Tuesday, what do you think? And those conversations, you know, Giving Tuesday always began with a question mark. We were always asking people what they thought about the idea. And Giving Tuesday still does that. It's still very much focused on, this is a really simple idea. How could other people make it better? And it started to grow. And like year one, I thought we were going to have maybe 200 partners. And we had like 5,000. And it really kind of caught the imagination of the moment. And it kind of began to settle as an idea. And then to the great credit of the nonprofit industry, who are so often maligned, right, or attacked by all sorts of people for not being very entrepreneurial, for not changing, for sticking the same, people all over the country and then very quickly all over the world started grabbing this idea and making it more interesting, like creating community campaigns, working out ways to tie this to volunteering, giving clothes, giving shoes, bringing together communities. And you know, we're 10 years on now from Giving Tuesday's beginning. And, you know, it's generated billions of dollars of revenue for the nonprofit sector and, you know, countless hours of volunteering. And it's now in 100 countries. And, you know, it really has scaled in ways that we would never have imagined. But one of the reasons for that is it's always kept simple. It's always been a very simple idea. It's never got over its skis. It's never tried to be something it isn't. And a lot of the credit for that actually belongs to the Giving Tuesday team. You know, if you say about kind of no one knows where it started, no one also really knows how it keeps going. And the 92nd Street Y, to its great credit, spun Giving Tuesday off to become an independent organization. And Asha Curran, who I know you know, now is the CEO of Giving Tuesday. And she, of course, was one of the co-founders back in the beginning. And the amazing thing about Giving Tuesday, which I never expected, is how the team of people running it now have managed to scale that culture around the world. Right, so Giving Tuesday takes place in more than half of the countries around the world, speaking countless different languages, different politics, different cultural connections. And yet, no matter where you are in the world, Giving Tuesday feels the same because they've managed to scale the culture, which is just an incredible thing. I saw a thing on Instagram yesterday where right now, and this is not on Giving Tuesday, this is just every Tuesday of the year, or every Tuesday at least right now, there's a pizza parlor in Mexico. Where if you buy the Giving Tuesday pizza, you get a pizza and they donate a pizza to the local hospital, right? Isn't it crazy that an idea that began on the Tuesday after Thanksgiving in New York City, now 10 years later on a random Tuesday in March in the middle of a pandemic, is encouraging somebody to buy a pizza for a medical worker? Like that, I still can't quite get my head around that, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's so important because, you know, we've seen over the last 12 years or so a decline in the number of people giving to charities. And what Giving Tuesday is a shot in the arm to all of us to think about ways we can make a difference, whether that be a donation, whether that be helping a neighbor, whether that be just standing up for something we believe in. And I just think that you and your team and Asha and all the people who got that going deserves so much credit. And it is an asset that our society, that our world has, that is sorely needed.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think the credit is really with the people who, and especially, you know, thinking about, you know, the people who will be listening to this podcast and your world, the people in the nonprofit sector who just really have made Giving Tuesday so, you know, we had the honor of kicking it off, but like the way in which the sector has made this so powerful, and every year it gets smarter and the data generated and the lessons learned and all of these things, like that was never centrally prescribed. It was because the sector responded and on a human basis, you know, it's you know, Giving Tuesday, it's hard to think of anything else which ties so many different groups of people together. You know, it reminds us that giving is something we all share, right? There are so many things that easily divide us right now, that we have to focus on those things that we all share.
Yeah. Well, there was a secret to figuring out how to get people to join together the way that they have on this. And I know that you have a book that you've written along with Jeremy Hammons called New Power, How Movements Build, Businesses Thrive, and Ideas Catch Fire in Our Hyper-Connected World. And I want you to talk about the premise of this book. And I'm curious, really, whether this book was born as an idea after the creation of Giving Tuesday, which seems to utilize so many of the ideas presented there, or whether it was the other way around. You had this idea for a book and you decided to use Giving Tuesday as a test case. But in any event, they seem to tie together quite well, the ideas that you've expressed in this book. And also, I'm just curious, I've always asked, I ask all our guests this question, what was it about your early life that sort of led you to this place? You certainly weren't born in the New Power era. You know, you were born in the Old Power era, but I suspect that through your travelings and experience, you also began to see the world reshaping in a new power dynamic.
The New Power work kind of grew up alongside Giving Tuesday. I always think of myself as a practitioner, not a thinker. What I mean by that is there, you know, I've got a day job, right? I run a big cultural organization. I used to run another one. And, you know, the phone rings at odd hours. There's lots of things going on. And then the thing I did outside that was more thinking, was trying to understand what does this all mean, right? And how does that fit together? And so the book came out of that, which was I was trying to kind of unpack some trends we were all feeling, you know, if you take your mind back to kind of 2014, 2015, and we were all thinking about how the world's changing and like the Arab Spring and what's really going on and then the social media and all these kind of trends. And so we first wrote a piece for Harvard Business Review, which went very well in the sense lots of people read it and responded to it, which laid out this idea that there's this new power world where the way you get things done has changed. That, you know, it's really about how you can encourage people to upload their own ideas, about openness. It's not about a central leader being in charge of everything, but how do you get networks of people to work together? And so that was the theory behind the book, was also growing out of the practice with things like Giving Tuesday, where New Power was alive and well because we were designing these things in a new power way, right? The idea of not branding something is a very new power idea. The old power idea is it's only valuable if you own it, if you can stamp your name on it, right? You can all think about how many conversations you've had about how big your logo is going to be on a press release. And we very much designed Giving Tuesday in the new power way, but also along the way, as we were working on New Power and Jeremy and I were thinking about the book, I kept coming across examples of people who were doing things in new power ways who were proving effective. You know, so people who were approaching the world in a very different way and getting better outcomes. And so the book really became a way of trying to synthesize a lot of those lessons and hopefully to provide a book. You know, the book was designed for practitioners. It wasn't designed as a kind of think piece, but okay, look, ideas are spreading differently, right? The Ice Bucket Challenge is working differently than historically fundraising has worked. What is it in that that we can understand and what can we replicate? And so the book was designed in that sense. And again, we've been very fortunate because the book got more interesting as soon as it was published, which, you know, was a surprise, not a surprise to me, but it was the great delight was people took the ideas from the book and made them better, made them more interesting, made them more relevant. And so even now with the book, there's a book comes out next week called The New Power University. A gentleman called Jonathan Grant has written a book all about how to reimagine the university in a new power way. And again, it's kind of the fascinating thing, perhaps the thing I find most rewarding is how much of a return on investment ideas can have. You know, and Giving Tuesday is obviously the best example, which is like, you know, an idea from 10 years ago ends up with, you know, the pizza today. But with the book, you know, an idea from 5 years ago ends up with someone thinking carefully about how you reimagine the university. And so there's something very powerful about, for me, about the thinking. I like to think about and I like to work on the value of ideas. I think that's probably what's at the heart of my work. It's a very American question, Art, to kind of then trace this back to your childhood. This is kind of the kind of biography as therapy approach to the world. And I'm not sure, I guess I was always inquisitive. That's definitely true. I was always interested in stories in a way my work, if there's a theme in all my work, it's about stories, right? How you tell stories has been important. I think I've never been focused on just making money. I think I understand selling things, right? I've lots of jobs I've had have involved that, but I've always been attracted to organizations who are fundamentally thinking about their meaning in the world and how you lead to better outcomes and how you help people. I find that very, very rewarding. And I think that was a lesson from my childhood, no question. that my parents both were people who very much had a frame of the world that valued stories and the arts and the life of the mind in a way which has been a great gift. But you see, that was such wonderful. A bad answer. Better question for Americans, no, or at least people who were brought up in America. They do better. They do better with emotional fluency in that country.
Got it. I understand. But I will tell you, that's a delightful answer. And I wanted to dig into New Power just a little bit for those who haven't had a chance to pick up the book yet and just ask you to share some of the key elements that form the core of the book so that they'll rush right out and get a copy.
This is why I've never been the perfect author, because this is, you know, the moment in every podcast, whenever I'm listening to a podcast, I always think this is the inevitable moment where someone's going to start hard pitching me the book. So I promise not to try and hard pitch.
No. You're not about the money. We just talked about that. I can vouch for that. So.
Well, no, not driven primarily by the money. Let's not pass me as a saint in that perspective. Well, here's the argument. The book makes an argument. The argument is we think about how the world is changing, and we often think about how technology has changed, and we don't as often engage with how power has changed. So the argument the book makes is there is this new way of being powerful, which is about peer learning. It's about openness. It's about connection. It's about the power of uploading ideas. And the power as a current, right? It's something that flows and surges. And if you look at our world right now, you will see new power for good and bad playing out across every sector. So let me try and justify that argument. Look at the anti-vax movement right now, the vaccine hesitancy movement, right? That's a very much a new power phenomenon, right? There is not an old power general secretary of the anti-vaxxers who has a monthly meeting and issues a newsletter and everyone pays their fees to be part of their local chapter. The anti-vax movement and the vaccine hesitant movement is made up of lots of people in small groups contributing to a bigger idea who are all sharing their ideas and shifting outcomes, certainly in terms of people's propensity to take the vaccine, but also people's thinking in very meaningful ways. So things like anti-vaxxers is a perfect example. We look at the old power of the medical profession, the old power world is saying, like, we have all the answers, we know all of the expert things, we can prove the vaccines work, all of the old power is in place. But what's not proving very successful is new power is outflanking that old power often. That for all the evidence in the world, you can have as many degrees as you like. And with all those degrees in the world, if you can't actually make an argument that is shared between people, not from top down, but side to side, you're going to fall behind. So new power is that phenomenon. And if you look at the Me Too movement, if you look at Black Lives Matter, if you look at Extinction Rebellion, if you look at the elections of Trump and Obama, if you look at Facebook, if you look at Airbnb, they all share something, right? And that is people have worked out how to channel the energy of the crowd in a meaningful way. And it's that skill that is at the heart of new power. And what the book tries to say is, look, there's a whole lot of new tools that we need to learn in the new power world. So if you want your ideas to spread, the kind of press release mindset that was once the way you thought about that has shifted now to a completely new angle.
Okay, so we now have this new power framework. As an individual, what should I be doing if I want to be powerful in a new way?
I think the start to that is really thinking very carefully about the kinds of examples of people who are doing work and what you can learn from them. So one of the great treats of the book was you got to see examples of individuals who are using their power very differently and very effectively. So I'll give you an example. There's a group in the UK out of the National Health Service called the School of Healthcare Radicals. And it's like an innovation pop-up by this one group run by a woman called Helen Bevan, who has really reimagined how they think about training and learning as part of the National Health Service. And day after day, she is essentially leading this kind of new power masterclass in how you can help patients, help your colleagues, help lead better health outcomes by imagining your work in completely new ways. And so I think there are lots of people out there who certainly from my perspective, I spend a lot of time learning from other people who are approaching the world in new ways and finding better outcomes. And like with new power, I mean, obviously the obvious answer is please buy the book. But the more important answer is actually do the work, which is how much time can you spend in new power communities working on new power ideas?
Well, I imagine for those of us in organizations, there are lots of lessons here, because institutions are established generally to maintain status quo. And from time to time, we come across people who are, I would say, activist leaders, and they push us into directions where we haven't gone before. But it looks like today we need to certainly embed that attitude to some extent in our organizations, so that we're constantly looking at being less about the organization and more about the cause and the best way to move forward. I think your Giving Tuesday example was certainly the great example of, you know, we're not going to put our name on the Giving Tuesday logo. It's going to be out there for all to use. The focus was on the result, not the player, so to speak. But that also takes a fair amount of humility, ego-less and selflessness, I guess, if you would. How do people find incentive in that when, in some cases, there's no credit to be given? Do we have to look at our world as not being one in which we get credit for things?
I just think it's the wrong way to think about credit. I mean, you know, yeah, I think okay. especially in the nonprofit sector, right? I think we often confuse, we often spend too much time on credit, in the sense that, you know, we want to kind of get our CEO on TV, and we want to make sure that we, you know, get credit for the work and make sure that we get our brand out there. And look, you know, I raise money in New York City, which is essentially a, you know, a full contact sport. And I understand how you have to get things coming to your organization, not other people's. But equally, one of the most effective ways to create change is actually not to focus as much on credit and focus on impact, and let the credit become not the light that shines on you, but the reflected light from your work. And that certainly was true of Giving Tuesday. You know, okay, like no one ever went out of their way to like be the face of Giving Tuesday. There is no face of Giving Tuesday. There are millions of faces of Giving Tuesday. But if somebody had have done, just hypothetically, then it would have been all about them, right? It would have been their thing. And like, you know, one of the big questions actually for our sector has been, and it's true of funders in particular, funders tend to fall in love with social entrepreneurs, right? The powerful, dynamic individual whose personal story is transformative and has gone through a personal crucible and come out the other side with a renewed passion to enforce their sense of justice on the world, or whatever it might be. And that is fine up to a point, but if you're taking up all the space as an individual, though, what space is there for the movement that you're supporting? And so I do think a lot about the old power framing around credit is about, are you becoming more famous, more recognition? But actually, for new power, often the case that the brightest light is reflected. If you can get other things to happen at a greater scale, that's actually going to be more beneficial to you in the long term. And so I certainly, from my perspective, think that's the way to think about that shift.
Well, I'll tell you, Henry, I've read the book many times, and I was happy to get my first copy from you back in 2018, just before it actually went for live publishing, I think. And in that amount of time, we've seen change in the world. And I just wonder if you had a chance to write a postscript to it, what might be included in that?
So much. I mean, that's been the crazy thing, is it's so much as since the world gets, in a way, the world gets more new power every day. You know, just look back at the last weeks. I mean, the last couple of months, that Wall Street Bets, very much a new power phenomenon, right? Which is this, you know, crowdsourced group of investors on Reddit upending the traditional old power market. If you look at what's happening in Russia right now, you know, the Navalny opposition is very much predicated on some new power tools. They're leading to protests not seen before. Their YouTube strategy has very much been about how you share a narrative which is damaging to the Putin regime. If you look at what's happening in India, what's happening in Brazil, you're seeing time and again these moments where the kind of new power of participation is upending political outcomes in ways nobody expected. So I think the postscript is that, you know, I think the book would, I think a lot of examples would change. There'd be lots of new examples, but some of the principles would stay the same, which is there are a new set of tools and rules for this world, and we all have to start trying to work out what they are if we want institutions to survive. Because your point you made a moment ago, Art, about institutions is they do become conservative institutions, but they didn't all start that way. right? When institutions began, they were usually very innovative, right? They were very exciting. They were very dynamic. There was this new thing they were going to do, and it was great. Wow, isn't this cool? And then, you know, 3 decades, 5 decades, 10 decades pass, and, you know, they become the man, right? That often can be the trajectory. So I do think one of the things with institutions is actually this sense of how do you reinstitutionalize? How do you take these great institutions and reimagine them in fundamental ways, from who they serve to how they serve to how they're governed to how they think about impact? And I think that process is so important, because it's really easy to be anti-institutional right now. And certainly there are lots of institutions who have not served the world as fully as they should, no question. But we need institutions, right? Democracies thrive on good institutions. So we have to build some. And I think some of them will be startups and new institutions, and some of them will be great institutions who work out ways to be even greater. And so I think about that shift. I think about that shift a lot in the day job.
Well, look, Henry, I want to just thank you for checking in with me and agreeing to be a part of this podcast. I think your book is critical reading for any nonprofit leader, or any person for that matter, who's trying to bring about significant and lasting change. So I want to commend it to people. So, you know.
Well, I want to thank you, Arne, for your long-term, your leadership and your friendship. You know, I remember the event, one of the things I learned the most from in recent years was you had that wonderful event where you brought together a group of thought leaders from the philanthropy world to really think carefully. It must have been 2 or 3 years ago now, right? To bring everyone together.
Down in Florida
to bring together some people from very different sectors to think about what are some of the common challenges we have. And I remember thinking the lessons I learned from that convening were just so powerful over time, and especially now as we think more carefully about what next for the world post-pandemic. So I think, you know, the work you do with your day job in terms of the BBB Wise Giving and the critical work you do for the sector, but also the way that you have brought the sector together to think bigger, is something we're all very grateful for.
Well, thank you for that, Henry. And I want to thank all of our listeners for checking into this podcast. And you can find us, if you want to, on all major podcast platforms for other episodes. And I appreciate your attention and your time for listening into our show today. Thank you.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. Send your comments and ideas to Nona@thusmarket.com. That's Nona@thusmarket.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only, and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.